Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and this is Crave, a podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre and television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
And this week, I was sure that after the nonsense that Simon was talking last week about The Revenant, I was sure that at the very least we'd see eye to eye at last with Quentin Tarantino's highly questionably numbered but brilliantly produced Hateful Eight. In the end, I do wonder, did you even see the same film I did, mate?
Actually, well, I think I did. The only title said The Hateful Eight, but...
We shall talk.
We shall talk. What I can say is that we are in sync, at least I think we are, because we sat next to each other, on a film called The Lady in the Van, which is the film adaptation of Alan Bennett's 15-year relationship with a lady in a van. Said lady portrayed with consummate class by Dame Maggie Smith.
Oh, yes, the woman can do no wrong. More of that later.
Indeed. Now, that's not just films we're talking about this week, though.
Indeed. We've got a bit of music to talk about. I've been out and about seeing some very, very different music. UB40, there's a name from the past, isn't it? They've been touring again. They're still playing the same old songs.
They do tour a lot, you know. They're a little bit like that Briscoe's ad. There's a sale on at Briscoe's. Oh, UB40 are touring again.
Yeah, they do what they do quite well, and they just keep on doing it. Why not? And why would be a better question to ask about Adam Lambert, talent show runner-up. I'm going to be very careful what I say about him, though.
Yes,
we'll go into that in much greater detail presently.
Yes, I understand you needed a good dose of your thick skin for that job.
Yes, I've got a little bit of a pasting for that. But you know what? That's what we do.
Yep, we go out and take the hard knocks. Television caught my eye this last little while. I watched TV1's Sunday night British drama Dr. Foster, which actually turned out to be a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday night drama as well.
Yes, I want to hear all about that coming up shortly.
But let us start with the cinematic medium.
Absolutely. We're going to start with The Hateful Eight, which is allegedly Quentin Tarantino's eighth film. Should we just get that bit out of the way right now? It's not his eighth film.
Is it?
Well,
isn't it?
It depends how you're accounting these. It really does.
Okay, I'm at the risk of being shown how ignorant I am. Reservoir Dogs.
Yep.
Pulp Fiction, that's two.
Yep.
Now, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2, is that two films or one film?
Well, to make it work, we have to make it one film.
Oh, do we?
We do, indeed.
Okay. Oh, hold on, I missed out Jackie Brown, didn't I?
You missed out Jackie Brown?
Okay. Okay. Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, they're two of the more recent ones, but I'm probably missing one or two.
Well, there was Death Proof and Grindhouse.
Now, did he direct those? I thought he just produced them, or did he actually direct them as well?
Well, according to IMDb, we've got a written by credit. For director, oddly enough, he's got 17 credits. But the classic... Death Proof and Grindhouse on IMDb as one, it's ambiguous. It was released originally as one film and then eventually it was spun out as two separate ones, so it's hard to know how to account for them. We also have to know, what do we do with films that he wrote and didn't direct? Are we allowing those as Tarantino films? Because if not, then we have to exclude From Dusk Till Dawn and we have to exclude True Romance, both of which were quite good. True Romance was exceptionally good.
Yes, yes. Oh, so actually, when we say his eighth film, this is all rather murky and hazy, which you might say is nothing like The Hateful Eight itself, Steve, but I didn't, I don't know, I wasn't taken by this at all.
Share your misgivings with us.
Yeah, well, I must say, just first of all, I thought, oh, this guy, he's got his street cred down, absolutely nailed it, because he's got Ennio Morricone doing the score. This is the guy who did the famous, you know, from the...
That's
that one, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So I thought, yeah, this is going to be fantastic. But not to put too fine a point on it, I was underwhelmed. I was. I thought the previous two films, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, were fantastic, were really good. I just thought this seemed, Steve, just a little too familiar for me. And it didn't take me anywhere unexpected, I guess. I mean, those previous two films, again, they took in the epic but the awful themes of Nazism in Inglourious Basterds,
yep.
The racism of the American South in Django Unchained. And while that Southern racism, you know, it comes up again in this film, I just thought The Hateful Eight pretty much played as a straight-up sort of comedy mystery. You know, who's the double-crosser? It's perhaps a little bit like Reservoir Dogs in that respect.
Well, in many ways, yeah. I mean, it was Revenant Dogs, really, wasn't it? It was Reservoir Dogs with snow. But as Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction did, it didn't deal with anything. I mean, the two that you just mentioned deal with topics. They address issues. But historically, he's never done that. He's had people shooting each other. And that's kind of what he's going back to here.
He is. So what he does well. I guess after 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 films or whatever, as a viewer, I know that. And I'm looking for maybe a little variation on the theme. I mean, there are some familiar faces in the cast. I mean, he does, you know, Steve, he writes a good script. There's lots of humour in this film. What's in Auckland? That was a good line.
Yes.
But there's such a lot of talking, especially in that first half of the film.
I'm sorry, when you went to see a Quentin Tarantino film, what exactly did you expect?
But it was just so much.
I refer you to my previous comment. I mean, as you said, you know what he does. That's what he does. He talks his audience to death.
Yeah, I felt, I wouldn't say to death, but I was beginning to look around for a place to have a cup of tea and to lie down. And then there were some of the other sort of scenes and gimmicks that he uses, which are him, a head, another one being splatteringly blown off. Well, you know, that was pretty shocking and new, I suppose, way back in Pulp Fiction. But, I think I could see something a little different now. Anyway.
Well, you're right.
Why did you like it so much?
Well, for I think possibly for the very reason that you didn't like it. It's basically distilled essence of Tarantino. It's him doing what he does best. It's extraordinarily talky. It's wonderful speeches delivered with magnificent power by phenomenal actors. And that's something that he manages to pull out of people like nobody you'll ever see. It was, on that level, it was brilliant. It was gorgeous to look at. I mean, the story was slight. And it's got one of his favourite little tropes of having to go back and revisit things from a different perspective halfway through.
Yes.
It was, in many ways, it was Tarantino by the numbers. But at the same time, it was what he does, as you said, what he does being done very, very well. It was an extraordinarily complex and very, very richly multi-layered script. Characters were, with the possible exception of Tim Roth's character, I found him to be a bit of a caricature, to be honest. But otherwise, beautifully drawn characters, fantastically acted. And yeah, there was a little bit of a script. But this wasn't a film, it was a stage play. And going back,
yes,
to
true.
Reservoir Dogs, that's what he does.
Okay. You mentioned The Revenant. And actually, I wondered, as I was watching it, in fact, even in the opening scene, Steve, which take you to a stagecoach labouring through the snowy wilderness,
yes,
which couldn't help but make me think of Revenant, that actually, because I was so impressed by The Revenant only a week or so before, I think that led to my sense of slight underwhelming vibe that just seeped through my bones on this one. So I may have been paying the price for being so impressed with The Revenant just previously. I'm not saying don't see it, but I certainly wouldn't rank it in the sort of the upper group of Quentin Tarantino films for me anyway.
No, I get the feeling he made this one for himself. This was a love letter to his own ego in some ways. and he's entitled to do that at this stage. He can do what he wants. One thing that could be fun to do, I'm sure you're not going to go back and see it again, but if you were,
yes,
take a piece of paper and note down every one of his little gimmicks or all the callbacks to previous films that he drops in. There's plenty. There's one or two that I can't possibly mention because it'd be big plot spoilers. But I mean, there's one moment when somebody is looking at something significant on the table, and there's a shaft of golden light comes down onto it. And if that doesn't call back to Pulp Fiction, I don't know what does. There's an awful lot of references back to his earlier films, which is entertaining for the audience, but it's fantastically self-referential.
Yes, yes. All right. Okay. I think that. Yeah. Okay. We'll agree to disagree. I'm not panning it by any means. But I wouldn't. If someone asked me, I'd say yes, buy a ticket. But if you know Tarantino really well, you're not going to be necessarily surprised by it. I'd certainly say that.
No, but I would say it's for fans only. To be fair.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you'll know if you want to buy a ticket. You don't need us to tell you for this one. You'll know.
That's true. Right. So if you're just joining us, by the way, this is Crave. It's the podcast where Steve McCabe and me, Simon Mercer, chat about all things entertainment. Now, the next film, Steve.
Yes, indeed. You'd be hard-pushed to find a greater contrast, I think, to be honest. You've got going from the high-octane, tense magnificence of The Hateful Eight to possibly the most... It's almost claustrophobic, isn't it? Lady in the Van.
Ah, yes, the work of Alan Bennett. Now, this is a film which tells the story of an elderly woman who's homeless, who ends up spending 15 years living rough in the back of a van, which happens to be parked in the driveway of writer Alan Bennett. And this is in his Camden Town home in London. And as we, the viewers, are told at the start of the film, this is mostly a true story.
Yes.
Uh-huh. We won't give too much away, but certainly we know that the lady's name is Mary, or perhaps it's Margaret Shepherd. And what actually is her story, and how she ended up living this rough life, and how the people of this Camden Town street react to her, including Alan Bennett, well, this is what the film is uncovering, and it's sort of peeling away layers of her backstory, revealing how Alan Bennett's Englishness, his northern Englishness, well, guides his decisions and his non-decisions about what to do about her. I guess, Steve, we probably don't need to say much more about the quality of this production other than to say that the lady is played by Maggie Smith, and she is in magnificent form.
There's your review right there.
It is. We'll stop now, shall we?
Yeah, I mean, it's written by Alan Bennett. It's got Maggie Smith in it. I mean, how could it be anything but priceless at that stage?
It was just, great, captivating, well-written, brilliantly acted. We should spend just a moment talking about Dame Maggie Smith. She's a pretty hard-working, ubiquitous actress these days. We were just mentioning her in Downton Abbey the other week, Steve. So people kind of know her, but I still felt I didn't feel overexposed by her work watching this film at all. I don't know. How about you?
No, not at all. I mean, can you have that? Can you have too much of such a wonderful thing? She's ubiquitous, but there's a very good reason for that.
Yeah, she's so good. Yes.
I mean, to be fair, though, I did see more than a little bit of the Dowager Countess.
Yeah, a little bit here and there. Yeah, yeah.
The slightly mad eye was definitely, you know, the one. She was definitely calling back to Downton Abbey in her performance. But I mean, in some ways, it's a very, very thin story. There's not really a whole lot going on. It's very much a character piece, and so you need a monumentally brilliant character actor.
Yes.
And you're simply not going to find a better one, are you?
No. In fact, I think a couple of things that will stay with me from this film are not necessarily some lines that she has to deliver, but there are a couple of scenes, one where into the film, she happens to stumble across a senior citizen's hall. She goes in. I don't think I'm giving too much away here, but she hears some music being played and she just stops and turns. She wants to leave, but she's drawn to sit down. And that all plays across her face in a just wonderful, wonderful way. And there's a little comedic little scene later in the film on getting into an ambulance and being hoisted up. Again, it's just all in her face. It's just Wonderful, wonderful acting.
It is she takes a somewhat slim role. I mean, in some ways, the character as written is very, very one-dimensional. Look at me, I'm barking mad. And that's all she's really got to work with. And she creates something quite beautiful. She finds dignity in the character, which I don't think is written into the script terribly clearly, but she finds it, and she portrays it quite wonderfully. I've got nothing but respect for her in that role.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned a really interesting thing there, Steve, about, you know, whether she's just barking mad, because we had a good chat about this afterwards, and I thought that was an interesting point you raised. Was this in some way making light, making drawing unfair humour out of mentally unwell or the homeless? Did you find yourself starting to feel that as you went through the film?
At the beginning of the film, I thought we were very definitely being encouraged not to laugh with her, but very definitely to laugh at her. This was a homeless woman, clearly a woman dealing with some kind of mental health issue. There was clearly mental illness going on. And we were being encouraged to laugh at her. She was being held up as a figure of fun and a figure of ridicule. All the neighbours in the street in Camden Town treated her with a combination of sympathy and ridicule. And we were basically being encouraged to tap into the ridicule that she was being treated with. And I think it's down really to Maggie Smith's performance that we start to realise that we shouldn't have been laughing at her. That it might be okay to laugh with her, and there's possibly a degree to which she's laughing with herself. But
yes.
It does need to redeem itself. I think it goes a long way toward redeeming itself toward the end, but it sets itself up for the need for redemption.
Yeah,
and that
it does.
Kind of gives me pause.
Yeah, okay. I think also that the film does poke a bit of fun, or it does aim some criticism at the attitudes of those sort of middle class English people living in that street who sort of feel that they need to outwardly display some degree of care towards her without actually taking it too far. And initially that applies to Alan Bennett himself, but of course he goes a step further. But the only other thing I'd say about that, Stephen, and that is that the very, very beginning of the film, the absolute beginning, we are given a few clues, visual and audio clues, about some events which happened earlier in the lady's life, which,
yes.
So you are being, as we, you know, okay, well, we are that degree of humour laughing at it, but we probably think as we go through, we're going to find out a bit more about that. This mystery is going to be unraveled slowly, and that was in the back of my mind. There are a couple of other interesting things we should just quickly touch on. The way Alan Bennett portrayed himself was,
yes,
kind of interesting.
It was, and do you want to explain how he did that?
Yes, well, it was interesting. He was saying, here's a man who's a writer, and he's writing about his life. So to sort of show the man who writes and the man who lives, there are two Alan Bennetts in the story who talk to each other. One is always at the desk, almost always at the desk writing, doing the work of being a writer. And the other Alan Bennett is the guy out and about living his life, interacting with people, collecting the material which the other one would use to write. That's kind of what's going on there.
And they have discussions with each other on,
yes,
oh, are you going to write about her? Oh, I'm not sure yet. Do you think I should? And so he's actually bringing his inner monologue to life as an outer dialogue, which enabled him, rather, I suppose the other way of doing it would have been voiceovers.
But
I thought he came up with a nice device. I think one thing that did slightly bother me was, in fact, the portrayal of Bennett.
Alex
Jennings is from Essex.
Okay.
And he's playing a Yorkshireman.
Right.
Now, there's a degree to which, being a northerner myself, I see this as a little bit of blacking up, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, really?
It doesn't entirely sit well. And let's face it, Bennett is a very, very easy voice to caricature. He's got that sort of whiny, a bit,
yeah,
pathetic Yorkshire accent. And I couldn't help but feel that Jennings laid it on with a little bit too much of a trowel. And so while you have got the most phenomenally bone-dry wit from Bennett, he is as acerbic as you're going to hear. It's quintessentially English dry humour.
But when it's delivered in that endlessly whiny voice, after a while it started to grate.
Yeah.
Just a little.
And it
did feel like it was descending into caricature.
Yes, I mean, I agree with that.
There's one point where he remarks that I was about to do her a good turn, but not without thoughts of strangulation. and it's a lovely, sharp little line, but he just has to whine it a little bit too much.
Okay.
If you're going to find a flaw with the film, I think that's going to be it. Because otherwise, I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, really, really good. Just one other quick observation I'd like to make about it, and this is it. You're a Northern Englishman. I'm not an Englishman at all.
No, we know. We're aware of that.
Yeah, yes, yes. And I just thought that the way in which Alan Bennett writes in to his story, I'm not saying all English people like this, I don't know enough of them, but this idea that, you know, English people aren't necessarily that forthcoming, that touchy-feely, they'll stand back a little bit, they won't necessarily emotionally engage with other people, that timidity, and he brings that into his portrayal of himself, actually, and how far to go and to engage with the lady in the van. I thought that was pretty interesting. I found that quite insightful.
Yeah, he remarks at one point where an ambulance comes to collect her at one point, and he remarks that an ambulance driver does something that he could never bring himself to do. He actually touches her.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll notice that for the entire of the film, they basically lived together for 15 years. And by the end of it, they were still addressing each other as Mr. Bennett and Miss Shepherd.
Yes.
There are certain boundaries, certain lines that the English cannot cross. That's how we are. Like I say, he taps into that quite splendidly. He does a very, very good job of just hinting at the realities of the English psyche. He's been doing it for years, and there's not many people who do it much better. And when you give his lines to Maggie Smith, it's going to be good.
There's no need to ask whether we're going to buy tickets for this. Just a very, very quick thought about it. Rather odd, device used in right at the very end of the film.
Now be careful.
And I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that there's a departure from the standard format the film follows in its storytelling, which might surprise you.
Yeah, I all I'll say is it felt almost Monty Python to me.
I agree. It did. Maybe we should leave it there. We don't want to spoil it for people.
But definitely worth a look.
Okay, excellent. Again, this is Crave. He's Steve McCabe. I'm Simon Mercer. We're talking about what's been entertaining us. Now let's get on to some music. It's high time we did. Steve, you've been to a couple of international acts, I suspect, where they have fan bases from very different generations.
Very different demographics. Very, very definitely. One of the great things that I enjoy when I go doing concert reviews is looking at the audience and seeing where you fit in. And so in many ways, I fit in quite nicely at the UB40 concert that I went to see up at Matua Vineyard about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
I saw it the day after we recorded our last episode. And I am not a reggae fan. I'll make that absolutely clear. Reggae doesn't really do it for me at all. But I went along, saw a couple of great support acts. Jason Kerrison was not an name I was familiar with. He's doing the now standard one man and a guitar bit that seems that everybody's doing in the wake of Ed Sheeran.
Yes.
But then also Herbs were...
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And this is a band I knew very little about, except a conversation that you and I had over lunch a couple of months ago when we were talking about, it was your partner mentioned, a student who had been studying the lyrics of Herbs.
Well, she's doing a PhD on Herbs.
That's the one, yeah. That was the sole context I had.
They've got a big history. They are an important band in New Zealand's social as well as music history of the sort of, you know, the 70s and the 80s. Absolutely. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
There you go.
That's fine. I had no idea of that context. All I knew is, you know, we had that one mention of a student studying their lyrics. But beyond that, I didn't know anything about them. And I was delighted. They were great fun.
They've got some miles on the clock.
Oh, good Lord, yes. Three old blokes sitting on stools with guitars, playing some fantastic music. And I loved it. It was a great show. But then UB40 came on. First of all, I have to mention, incidentally, before I talk about the music, I have to mention the organisation of the show.
Yeah.
It was rubbish.
Oh no!
Bumped into a friend there this afternoon who said she'd seen me there. And she said, "Yeah, it was dreadful." She said, "I queued up for an hour to get in, and then I queued up for an hour to get a drink at the bar."
Oh dear!
It was very, very, very poorly organised. I mentioned this to the promoters, who did say, "Yeah, it's down to the venue, and some venues are great, and some venues aren't." And I'm afraid this one wasn't.
Well, they shouldn't have chosen it then.
Okay. You kind of go where it's available, and they set it as a vineyard tour because UB40 are still making a living out of one song in many ways.
Uh-huh. And what was the reaction to that song?
Well, obviously it was their set closer, and it got an enormous cheer.
Yes,
but I personally find "Red Red Wine" to be one of the most plodding and dull songs imaginable, and I realised it was going to be their set closer. So as they started playing, that was my cue to leave before the crowds did and got back to my car to drive off. But the rest of the show, having been massively negative until now, I have to tell you, was surprisingly entertaining and enjoyable.
Okay.
I had forgotten how many songs of theirs I knew from my youth. This was the music I grew up with in many ways in England in the 1980s. And so when they start playing songs like "One in Ten," which was a reference to unemployment in England back in the 80s.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that, first of all, there was some decently trenchant social commentary coming from these guys. And secondly, they wrote a decent tune.
Yeah. Well, actually, Steve, the name of the band, UB40, it's to do with an unemployment form, isn't it?
It is
benefit form?
UB40, and back in my youth I used to have one. When I graduated from university, I struggled to find work for a while. And so I would carry my UB40 down to the Dole office, and you take your UB40, hand it over, and they stamp it, and you sign your form, and that's how you get your Dole money. I'm sure they do it differently these days. But, UB40 was the unemployment benefit form.
Yeah. And what about those people who were there to take soak this all in? Were they of your generation or what?
Oh, absolutely. It was, I mean, there was a fairly broad cross-section of society there, but generally speaking, skewed toward white, middle-aged, middle class.
Yeah.
Very, very definitely. It was an interesting dynamic. Also worth mentioning, just as a bit of a curio thing, how the band came about, or how this iteration of the band came about. There are two versions of UB40 touring.
Oh, yes. There's been a dispute, hasn't there, about who has the rights to use that name?
Indeed. Ali Campbell, the singer from the band, was the first person to leave the original UB40. Then Astro, who's a second singer in the band, and Mickey Virtue, who's a keyboard player, then also left. So those three then said, well, let's get ourselves together and call ourselves UB40 again. And they're now involved in legal action with what they are referring to as the dark side, saying, no, we're UB40, even though we left UB40 independently and then regrouped. So the whole thing's getting very, very messy. And I got to meet them about 2 weeks before they played up in Auckland. They did a press call, and I asked them, is there any chance of a rapprochement, any chance of you guys getting back together? And it was pretty unequivocal.
Oh.
Not a chance. And I said, that sounds like the sound of bridges burning. Oh, no, they're burning the bridges, not us.
Oh, I see.
So the politics of the band are almost as fascinating as the music.
Okay. Anyway, I think that if they came back, you'd be telling me, Simon, nip along there. You might quite enjoy yourself at the UB40 concert.
You'd be surprised. Like I say, better than I expected them to be. I went in thinking, yeah, go on, let's see what it's all about. And at the end, I came away thinking, I'm really glad I went to that.
Oh, good stuff. I wouldn't have thought at first glance that you would have necessarily rushed out to grab a ticket to see Adam Lambert.
No.
I could be wrong, but I don't think I am.
again, not at the absolute pinnacle of my list.
No.
I was asked to review this for one of the other entertainment outlets for which I write and photograph.
Yes.
And so I went along. And just to give a little bit of backstory here, Adam Lambert was a runner-up in American Idol.
Yep.
Who did a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and was then plucked out of the seeming approaching obscurity by Queen.
To
replace Freddie Mercury, which obviously is always going to be an impossible task, except that apparently he did it rather well.
Yeah. Well, Steve, just a nip in there, because I didn't see much of American Idol, but I think I saw a few episodes of the season that he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my memory of it was that he was had by far the best voice in terms of just a voice. And I think I remember when they got down to the final two and the other bloke won. I don't remember the other guy's name, but I'm sure the only reason the other guy won was because Lambert was so obviously out there and gay and flamboyant, and maybe a lot of Americans didn't feel comfortable with voting for him. But he was by far the strongest voice. And I'm kind of interested to know, just when you're sitting there or standing there in front of him and hearing him sing live, how good is his voice?
He's got a great voice. The big problem is he's not got great tunes.
Ah.
He's got three albums of his own material. And if you look at the writing credits on these albums, every single song is written by him and about usually three to five other people. And it's different people on each track. So even though his fans will insist that, oh, he writes his own music, no, he doesn't really. He has a writing credit on his own stuff. And I wrote my review pointing out that while he can sing well, he's not really got the songs for a lot of the time. When he's going back to his old funkier glamour stuff, then it's got a lot more energy to it. But in the middle of the set, when I think it was on his second costume change, and he was wearing he got out of his ridiculous penguin suit that he started off in, and he's now wearing just a regular red crushed velvet, I think it was, suit. He came across as basically a poor man's Robbie Williams.
Ah.
And yeah, he's got a great voice, but he hasn't got the songs. When he's singing other people's songs, he sang, interestingly, he sang Let's Dance, the David Bowie song.
Yep, yep.
Interestingly, he added this to his set list after Bowie died. So
yes.
Clearly it's in as a tribute.
As a tribute, yeah.
Yeah. And he and his band nailed it. He sang it fantastically, even though he's not got what you would imagine would be a voice to sing a Bowie song.
No.
And yet, he did it fantastically well. But in keeping with the fact that he didn't address the audience more than twice in the entire show, there was no acknowledgement that it was a Bowie song, even though I'm fairly confident that Bowie must have been a massive influence on the man.
You'd think. And you say not talking to the audience, and yet this is in a relatively informal setting, a relatively small setting of the Auckland Town Hall.
Yes, indeed. I mean, he played, apparently, Vector Arena with Queen. And that seems like a more appropriate kind of venue for him and for the kind of show he was trying to put on. You could tell he was trying to squeeze an arena show into a theatre setting. And on that level, it worked, but there was no intimacy to it at all. No personal charisma. Yeah, I mean, he's a flamboyant showman, but no, it felt very, very impersonal. It felt, he sang the first two songs with wraparound sunglasses on. You couldn't even see his eyes. And I was down in the photo pit right at the very front, and all I could see was a man who was just, as far as you could tell, was just staring straight out to the very back of the room. There was no sense of engagement with the audience that I felt.
Okay. And so when you pointed this all out, Steve, the floodgates of vitriol opened for all those fans of his around the place.
Yeah, how dare you criticise my favourite band?
The temerity.
You said something rude about Adam.
Oh,
and
no.
You're horrible and you're mean. And unfortunately, I mean, he's got a devoted fandom, apparently is the word we're using these days. And apparently various bands have their own fandoms these days, and they give themselves nicknames. So if you're a fan of Justin Bieber, apparently you're a Belieber, which is... I can barely bring myself to say the word. One Direction fans call themselves Directioners, apparently. and devotees of Mr. Lambert call themselves Glamberts.
Ah, not Lambertians. Okay.
Oh, that would be far too sophisticated. No, apparently they call themselves Glambert. And I posted a link to my review on Twitter, as I always do. You know, it's fairly standard practice. And for the next 36 hours, I thought my phone was going to melt. I was from all the constantly buzzing, and the vitriol was less than pleasant, to be perfectly honest. People who clearly hadn't been at the show, didn't know what had actually happened at the show, but could not countenance the possibility that Adam might have done anything other than deliver the most perfect and flawless show ever. And the fact that that I could possibly have found fault with it meant that I have no business reviewing shows and should just shut up and go home. One fellow, I think it's a bloke, I'm not quite sure, did tweet, "Dude, you upset the wrong fandom. We Glamberts are loyal." Apparently I'm a loser. I have no business writing. And where is it? Finally, somebody goes by the name of Delilah tweeted to me, "What are you talking about? You need to relax, have few drinks, close your Twitter account, and stop to write concert reviews." So that told me.
People have no idea what a review is. Anyway. Yeah.
No, well, from now on, all my reviews are just going to be that song from the Lego Movie, "Everything is Awesome." That's it. "What do you think of that show?" "Everything is awesome." That's it. That's all I'm going to say. Must never criticise anything. Yeah, The Revenant, it was perfect. UB40, best band ever. Adam Lambert, OMG, he's wonderful. That's it. That's all I'm ever going to do ever again, because otherwise I might upset somebody. And that wouldn't do now, would it?
But the thing is, they read what you wrote, you see.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that's the good thing. All right, yeah. Adam Lambert.
There is only one thing worse than being talked about, Simon, remember?
Indeed. Yes. Well, of course, that would never happen in our case, Steve. Shall we finish with some TV, if that's all right?
Tell me what you've been watching.
Right, well, I wanted to just mention this. As much about how it was delivered as the content, I'm talking about what started out for me as a piece of television entertainment and ended as a piece of internet entertainment.
Oh, yeah?
I'm talking about TV One's broadcast of the British drama Dr. Foster.
Right.
So episode one screened on a Sunday night, and rather than invite viewers to come back for another four Sundays after that, TV One decided to run them all back-to-back over successive nights.
Right.
This is really what I want to talk about. I'd only briefly talk about the drama itself, which was, I thought, actually pretty good. The story is about a smart, hard-working, loyal Dr. Foster who's confronted with the apparent cheating of her husband, who, it turns out, thinks it's okay, quite all right, to love his wife, but also to love the 22-year-old daughter of the man who's bankrolling his latest building project.
Yeah, good on you, mate. The bounder.
Yeah. Dr. Foster is played by Surani Jones, and she plays the doctor as to be honest, a rather unhinged character. Ooh. Which is good in a way because it kind of keeps you guessing about how far is this woman prepared to go to exact her justice. But justice she seeks and justice she finds. And I won't say any more about it other than that. But it was pretty good. But the whole thing about it, and I'm interested in your views on this, Steve, this whole idea of TV Ones, and I guess they're trying to surf the wave of people increasingly employing a binge attitude to devouring TV, you know, would you or could you actually sit down over five successive nights and follow a television program? I don't know if you could actually do that, Steve.
Absolutely. Very, very, very definitely, if it's good enough.
Yeah, Yes.
That's got to be the question, is does this show have the strength to keep you going, or do you find yourself after the second show going, oh god, are we watching another one tonight? Does it carry you? And clearly in your case, sounds like it did.
Yeah, mostly it did. I mean, I think it engaged me. I certainly wanted to see how it ended. I guess that's the most important thing, isn't it? You stick with it, even if you might have a few little questions along the way. But the central character was just, as I say, a little madcap, and you just weren't quite sure which way she was going to jump. So it succeeded on that level for me. But I just was interested in where this is all going, Steve, this idea of, you know, if you had an appointment one of those five nights, of course you could go online and watch it on demand, and which, in fact, I did on several of the nights, at least three of the nights, that's how I watched it. But then these days, some broadcasters are not even bothering with that. I'm aware that Netflix, which of course is now officially here in New Zealand, a couple of their more recent series for TV. These are the Marvel series Daredevil and Jessica Jones. When they launched the series, they put all the episodes out available at once.
Yes.
They didn't stagger them at all. They said, here they are, there's 8 or 10 of them. You just watch them whenever you want. That's it. Done. So that just takes the whole idea of appointment viewing, well, just takes it and throws it out the window, really. You just, whenever it suits you, you watch it.
But increasingly, that's becoming the case with, I mean, you just demonstrated yourself. You say that you didn't wait until...
No.
It's 9 o'clock. It's time for Dr. Foster. And yeah. You said, oh, I've sat down and it's on my box now. I'll turn it on because I'm ready.
Yeah.
That's how we're watching stuff these days.
It is. And you just kind of wonder how far away we are from a time when many households won't even have a TV set. We'll just all have our laptops or whatever screen, other type of screen we're going to use.
That would be my household.
Of course.
We haven't bothered with the TV in years. We download our shows to watch when we feel like. It suits us better that way. It's a different way of doing things. I mean, let's face it, that's what we're doing with a podcast.
Yeah, we are. Absolutely. Even if it's things like news broadcasts or whatever, you can still watch them online. You don't have to sit down at 6 o'clock or whatever to watch a news bulletin, for example, or whatever. So, yeah, it's going to happen. It might be another one more generation to tick along, but...
But
anyway.
If you think about it, this is... You know, there is nothing new under the sun, is there? The first hints of this started back in, I guess, in the 1980s when we had miniseries. You remember?
Yeah.
Things
yes.
like Roots or the Thornbirds, where they would show them on consecutive evenings, and the difference then would often be longer episodes as well. They would often be, say, 90-minute episodes, feature-length episodes. But the same concept yes. existed back then of a show. I mean, they obviously couldn't do the broadcast them all, well, make them all available at the same time. The technology wasn't there. But the releasing them effectively at once, rather than the traditional sort of Tuesday night is Mad Men night and Thursday night is Game of Thrones night. Instead
yes.
of that model, it was, oh, this show is going to be out this weekend. It's
yeah.
a very, very different approach that we're going back to, oddly enough.
Yeah. Actually, there's another program which I want to talk about next time. It's just started again on TV2 this time. This is the, yet again, a revisiting of The X-Files.
Yes.
And I think that when it was at the TV2 showed 2 episodes back-to-back to start the thing rolling. So that's something I'd like to have a look at in the next episode of Crave. What else is coming up in the next little while, Steve?
There's a few things coming up. In terms of films are actually looking quite exciting in the next couple of weeks. Steve Jobs, the almost but not quite biopic, is opening next week.
Yep.
We will be... taking a swing at that one. It looks quite interesting. It's getting some very, very good reviews. We've got Michael Fassbender as the eponymous Mr. Jobs. It looks
damned good actor, that chap.
Absolutely. Interestingly, he's got Seth Rogen as Steve Wozniak. That's an interesting choice. We'll remain to be convinced on that one. And John Sculley, Apple's first brought in CEO, is played by Jeff Daniels.
So
I'm kind of fascinated to see how well that comes out. So we've got that coming up very shortly. And then the following week, Zoolander.
Zoolander 2.
Zoolander 2. Toolander, whatever you want to call it. Now, that one I can't wait for. When I realised that they were doing a sequel and we'd be going to see it, my wife and I, using obviously Netflix, watched the original Zoolander. And guess what?
You liked it.
It holds up better than you'd ever imagine.
Okay.
It's funny. So that's going to be... Steve Jobs is opening on the 4th. So that's mm-hmm. next week. Zoolander, I believe, isn't going to be in cinemas the following week. We've got a press screening in about a week and a half time, so we'll be able to discuss that on our next episode. And then there's some interesting music coming up. As well, some big musical events. This being Auckland Anniversary Weekend, Monday sees the Laneway Festival.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. There's a couple of other big ones. One guy I'm fascinated to see, very, very low-key performer, a chap named Anthony Stretch, is going to be playing a North Island tour. There's details of that on our website, cravepodcast.com. Auckland City Council are putting on a series of free concerts round and about. Mm-hmm. And on February the 13th, so 2 weeks from today, hang on, nope, I'll yes. tell a lie. I tell a lie, I got that one wrong. 27th, about 4 weeks from today, yeah. Rock in the Park, Sheehan and Villainy are playing a free show in Grey Lynn Park.
Oh, both of whom opened for AC/DC, of course.
The very fellows, yeah. So they're back together. They're back playing on the same bill, and that's a free show.
Oh, fantastic. Okay,
and one that you'll be interested in, Simon.
Yes.
Later in February, again, part of the free shows that the City Council are laying on is going to be on the Sunday the 28th, Tammy Nielsen.
Oh, okay. Well, I would, yep. We've talked about her in the past. I thought she was excellent live. And that she's well worth a visit. Okay, absolutely. Good stuff. A lot of stuff coming up.
There's a lot of good stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. Yes. All right, lots to talk about when we next return with Crave, which is what you've been listening to.
Why not?
you can email us, by the way, at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
We're on Facebook, of course, or you can follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
I think we nailed it.
Lovely.